Hello and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, the platform that brings financial reporting, ESG audit, and risk teams together to help you provide assured, integrated reporting. It's cooler than a hot dog jumping into a swimming pool during the dog days of summer. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. I'm looking forward to debuting a great conversation and am so happy to have you with us. I am, as always, also very happy to have Catherine Tsai joining us. Catherine, do you want to intro yourself?
Sure. I'm not an accountant or a Diet Coke aficionado, but I like to ask questions. I like to drink venti soy chais, and I'm looking forward to our next guest.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we've got a famous guest today. We have joining us Cynthia Cooper, who was one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002 for alerting WorldCom's audit committee to one of the largest accounting frauds in history.
She wrote a book about it called Extraordinary Circumstances.
That's right. We plan to ask her about that. And this episode is also dropping on the same week as National Whistleblower Appreciation Day, where Cynthia and Sharon Watkins and other notable whistleblowers are actually going to be on Capitol Hill talking about all of the great things that they've done and recognizing the importance of whistleblowers. So with that, let's get to our conversation with Cynthia Cooper.
Thank you, Steve. I'm excited to be here with you and Catherine.
Well, we're excited too. And let's jump right in. Cynthia, just to start off, what keeps captivating people about WorldCom, even Enron, Bernie Madoff, even Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos? What keeps people going back to these stories, to these, you know, pivotal moments that frankly involve a lot of kind of bad news and bad things?
That's a great question. I think most of these big scandals, the ones that you mentioned, these are stories about companies who were at once at the very height of success. In some cases, it was just perceived success. But you had companies that were at one time highly respected on Wall Street, executives who were at the pinnacle of their success and very respected. For example, Scott Sullivan, the CFO at WorldCom, was once the highest paid CFO in the country. He received the CFO of the Year award from CFO Magazine for his work in mergers and acquisitions. Bernie Madoff was the chair of the NASDAQ. So I think we are captivated by the stories. What caused these companies to collapse? Was it the fraud, or were there other things at play, maybe from a risk management, internal control, strategy perspective? And I think we're just naturally curious, what can we learn about these organizations so that we can prevent failures going forward? And in general, I think it's human nature to want to study history and learn from that history. And so I think these cases provide a lot of insight. They allow people to step in the shoes of other people in a safe environment and imagine what they might have done if they were perhaps one of a member of the C-suite, the board of directors, perhaps working with the internal auditors or external auditors, or even imagine that they were a perpetrator in the shoes of the mid-level managers who became complicit in some of these cases, and even the senior executives. And so I think those are the reasons that we continue to be fascinated with these cases. And of course, Enron and WorldCom are two cases that continue to be taught in business schools across the country. And if you remember when the Enron fraud occurred, many members of Congress thought that it was just one bad apple. And of course, WorldCom occurred the next year. And because of those two frauds, Congress quickly passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which has been, you know, one of the most sweeping pieces of legislation that we've had.
I feel like what keeps people captivated about your story and Enron as well, it has a heroine. It actually has somebody who is brave enough to raise their hand. How do you think about or maybe handle that attention? I mean, clearly your career, I would argue maybe your life, has changed dramatically since then.
Yeah, yes. I mean, absolutely, it's changed dramatically. You know, who would envision that they would ever be involved in something like this? And I write in my book, Extraordinary Circumstances, that my team and I were ordinary people who found ourselves in these extraordinary circumstances. And we were, you know, trying to navigate that and, you know, do our jobs well. For me, I think the things that really guided me were my personal values. And I was blessed to have a really strong team. I always say that I wasn't able to hire many. I had a department of about 40 employees, but I hired some of the very best. And most of them had multiple professional certifications, graduate degrees, many years of expertise. And I think that that really made a big difference in terms of unraveling the fraud and also navigating the aftermath, because it's the aftermath of the fraud that's so difficult. WorldCom, it was over 2 years before I was finally testifying in federal court in that case. So these cases tend to drag out for years and years and years. But back to your original question, I think that I would tell you that I and my team both view ourselves as just ordinary people who were trying to do our jobs and do them well.
I know we're a couple of decades out from WorldCom and Enron, but what is the risk of forgetting cases like this?
Well, the risk of forgetting is that history repeats itself. And there's a great quote that's sometimes attributed to Mark Twain, and he wrote that while history may not repeat itself, it often rhymes. And that's very true. So the risk of either not studying history at all, not taking action based on history or forgetting history, is that we continue to make those same errors and mistakes going forward.
Cynthia, we've talked on previous episodes of this podcast about accounting fraud and maybe what can be done to prevent it. And one of the themes that comes up in those conversations is this slippery slope where what might seem like a really innocent move actually ends up being the first step towards crossing the line to outright fraud. And I'm wondering, you know, in your opinion, especially after all of the things that you saw at WorldCom but have certainly seen since, what can help organizations stay on the right side of that line? Or maybe said in another way, how does an individual know when they perhaps crossed that line and now needs to dial it back or do something different or undo what they may have unintentionally done?
Yeah, I mean, because organizations are obviously made up of individuals, so we want to make sure that all employees and executives are on the same page. We want to, first of all, we want to make sure that we've set clear expectations, that employees understand what the values are within the organization, that they're in alignment. You want their personal values to be in alignment with the core values of the organization, that you have a clear code of conduct. You want to make sure that you have culture and fraud prevention training across the organization at all levels within the company, and that you provide employees with the tools to make sure that, first of all, to make sure that they're able to recognize an ethical dilemma, that they are able to stop, step back, think it through, and make the right choices. So maybe having an ethical decision-making framework that you roll out in the organization and continuing to communicate these messages, you know, throughout the year. It's not just a one-time training, but that these messages are cascaded throughout the organization. That said, Steve, I think it's important to recognize that most of these scandals that we see involve executives at the very top of the organization, and they involve collusion, people working together at the highest levels. So it's critically important that we not only reach employees, but that we reach the C-suite, and that needs to come often from the board. And I think the more we bring ethics to the forefront of our thinking, whether we're the C-suite or, you know, staff-level employees, then the more likely we are to recognize that dilemma, to really think about the consequences of our actions. How would my decisions impact not only myself, but other people? To make sure that we are asking ourselves whether is it legal? If it's not legal, you want to go back and obviously rethink it. But just because something is legal does not mean it's ethical. I think especially students sometimes get that confused. So is it legal, but is it ethical? Is it the right thing to do? How would I feel with my decision landing on the front page of the newspaper? How would I feel about maybe my parents or my children, my spouse, knowing about my decision? And it's important to make sure that employees don't place too much of their identity in a company or an organization. I think that's often what happened with some of the executives at the top of these companies. Their identity was so tied up in the organization that they allowed that to override some of their personal values. And I encourage employees at all levels to write their personal mission or vision statement. So organizations write their mission statement, but how many of us as individuals write our personal mission statement? And that really causes us to reflect on what our values are, what our priorities are, commit those to writing. Organizations, in addition to identifying their values, they should also identify and define their priorities. For example, one example might be people over profits or safety over product rollout. So if we have that messaging and it goes throughout the company, I think that people are definitely more inclined to really think about their choices. And we also want to make sure that we just have a strong, healthy speak up culture, that people feel comfortable speaking up at all levels within the organization, that they know who to call, that there's an anonymous reporting mechanism, and that we try to combat the reasons that people don't come forward in the first place. The top two reasons people don't come forward are fear of retaliation and the belief that nothing will happen anyway. So we want to make sure we take issues seriously, that we respond to people who speak up, and that we encourage people to speak up if they see something that's not quite right, or just to be able to call a helpline if they are not comfortable with the situation, but they're not quite sure how to move forward.
Cynthia, I have a quick, maybe a two-part follow-up question to that. You mentioned earlier students, and I'm wondering, is it right to sum up the advice to students as being, hey, if your gut tells you that something's wrong, that's when it's okay to raise your hand? I mean, do you think, Cynthia, that alone is enough to maybe, hey, well, at least go talk to your manager or go talk to somebody? Don't just sit in isolation. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm curious if that might be a really just simple, easy guideline.
Yeah, absolutely. I think listen to your gut, because your gut will often serve you well. If you read my book, I write at several points that I really relied on my instincts, and it's important to trust your instincts. If something doesn't seem or feel quite right, you know, listen to that. But it's also important to go back and use the other side of your brain, right? You know, go back to the facts, regardless of what your feelings tell you. Go back to the facts until you're comfortable with what you are being asked to do, and think about what paths you might be able to take. I think often when people are standing at the crossroads of some major ethical dilemma, they only see two paths to take. They don't envision all the different paths that they might be able to take. So I think that's important as well. Listen to your gut, go back to the facts, and then identify what paths you might take and why. And then it's important also to understand the law. So if you're thinking about speaking up and blowing the whistle, you want to know what you might be facing in the future. And you certainly want to know what type of legal protections there are and what you should do. And that's where really seeking legal advice comes into play.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you just a quick comment. You had mentioned collusion and collusion at the highest level. When there is collusion at the highest level, does that almost absolve everybody's behavior beneath that? I mean, if they were all acting in good faith, there was collusion at the top. Does that kind of like wipe away any not necessarily liability in terms of a legal concept, but just culpability maybe for everybody underneath?
Well, in the case of WorldCom, five people pled guilty to fraud and the CEO was found guilty in federal court. So some of the mid-level managers in this case were pressured to become complicit with fraud, and they gave into that pressure. I think that several of them believed that nothing would happen to them, that they were just following orders, that the CFO was instructing them to go in and make these entries in the company's books and records. But I was just following orders does not hold up very well in federal court. So, you know, above being loyal to your superiors, you need to be loyal to your own values and make sure that you don't cave under that pressure. And it can be so easy to give into pressure. The Milgram study, it was conducted after World War II to try and determine how the Nazis could have committed such atrocities. And so in this study, people were asked to come in and ask a person behind a panel who they can't see a series of questions. And each time the person answers the question incorrectly, they're instructed to hit a button and deliver an electric shock, increasing the voltage to the point where if this were real, that the person behind the panel would be dead. And a very high percent of people will continue to hit that button, increasing the voltage, as long as there is an authority figure pressuring them. You know, you've got to continue with the study. You won't get in trouble, but we've got to continue with the study. So I think the lesson there is for all of us, we need to make our decision before we come to the crossroads of that ethical dilemma, right? That decision essentially should be made for us by the decisions we've made throughout our lives, by the values and priorities that we hold dear in our lives. And so, at the time when you're sitting across from the CFO being pressured to become complicit with the fraud, that's not the time to make your decision. That's one of the things, Steve, that I hope that my book does is empower people to make the decision in advance. And I had a senior director in finance tell me that she, after reading the book and listening to me speak, that it had a profound impact on her life because she did make that choice. And she said now her decision's easy. If someone ever pressures her to do something that she does not believe is right, and if it's a significant issue, that she will take action or resign from the company. And I think that that's, and all of us can do that, right? All of us can begin to prepare ourselves in advance.
That goes back to what you were saying about just because something's legal doesn't mean it's ethical. I think that's important to keep in mind as the world changes faster than some of our laws can change. I'm thinking about cryptocurrency, artificial intelligence. We don't really have laws for all of those areas quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There will always be these regulatory gaps, especially when with the speed of change that we're seeing now in terms of technological advancement, complex financial instruments. There will always be these regulatory gaps that exist. And I think I'll mention another thing, and that is finding your courage. I think some of the people who became complicit with the fraud at WorldCom knew that this wasn't right. They were basically good people, but they weren't able to find their courage. And so I think, finding our courage or practicing finding our courage in the small matters makes it more likely that we'll find our courage when we come to that tough crossroads of an ethical dilemma. And I write in the book that a man wrote me this letter and he said, "Hey, my wife and I try to teach our children that courage is not without fear, but it's acting in the face of fear." And I think that's so, so true. I can tell you guys, hey, look, I was not this pillar of strength through this process. There were times literally when I was scared, my hands were shaking and my heart was pounding, and I had to find a way to push forward in the face of that fear. And one of the things I think that helped me were words from my mother that I heard as a young girl. And that was, think about the consequences of your actions, but also don't ever allow yourself to be intimidated. Literally from the time I was 5 years old, my brother and I would hear those words from her. And I think as much as anything, it's her words that helped me to find my courage, when I was in those tough spots.
Yeah. Well, if we look at some current cases that did cross the line where people have been convicted in a court of law, what do you think about some of those penalties and punishments? Did they actually fit the crime?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because there's so many different dimensions, I think, to that and layers to that question. If you look at some of the recent cases, like I read that Binance, the largest, I think, cryptocurrency exchange company, that they were recently fined over $4 billion. And so that sends a pretty strong message to the crypto market. On the other hand, I read about a Brazilian company that had a dam collapse, and they were fined by the SEC right around $50 million. And many people thought that that was just a slap on the wrist because there were over 200 people who lost their lives due to this dam collapse. So when you're thinking about whether the penalty fits the crime, context matters, right? That's why we have juries that go through entire cases and study all the facts of the case. As far as the sentencing, some of the things you would want to consider are, is it consistent with other like sentences? Is it a strong enough penalty to provide a deterrent to future potential fraudsters? And there are some studies that indicate that the size of the penalty in itself does not usually serve as a great deterrent to fraud. But the two best deterrents are really fear of imminent detection and the belief that the penalties will be consistent and consistently applied. So when you marry maybe a large penalty with consistency of holding people accountable, then those two things together can serve as a great fraud deterrent. In the case of WorldCom, the Bernie Ebbers, the CEO, was sentenced to 25 years in prison, and the CFO was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And the judge indicated that the CFO was the architect of the fraud. He decided what to do, how to do it, and instructed his staff members to perpetrate the fraud. So that, in my mind, that's a big gap in sentencing, 25 years and 5 years. But federal judges have there's a lot of judgment involved in sentencing. So there are guidelines. But the judge usually is the one who gets to decide whether you get 1 year and someone gets 5 years, somebody gets 25 years. So that's a lot of power. In addition, I will tell you that there is no parole for federal sentencing. It was done away with back in the 80s. So you can potentially get a 15% reduction for good behavior. But if you are not pardoned by the president or you don't have your sentence commuted, which is very rare, then you serve 85% of your sentence. So I guess in closing, I'll just say there are a lot of different things to consider when we're determining whether or not penalty is fair and provides justice and serves as a deterrent as well.
Are you relying on desktop tools and shared drives? Stuck in a vicious, never-ending cycle of back-and-forth emails? Wish you had more time to proactively manage risk? Stop wasting valuable time corralling colleagues and updating status reports and start spending more time on what matters with Workiva. Create alignment across key stakeholders. Yes, all of them. With centralized collaboration, drive better business decisions with insights on demand, and spend more time on value-added work by automating all those awful, repetitive tasks. Plus, connect your GRC processes with your ESG and financial reporting all in the same platform. Seriously. See why audit and risk teams love Workiva at workiva.com/risk. That's workiva.com/risk.
Cynthia, when we move beyond just this penalties, and I realize they're not all short-term, but maybe let's say immediate consequences, are there hidden longer-term consequences to the type of frauds that we've been talking about? I mean, one thing that I think about in the wake of WorldCom and Enron is Sarbanes-Oxley. We're still doing that work today. We're still dealing with it. It's still expensive, and it's still a pain. I don't know if you have a comment on maybe some of the hidden consequences that are impacting us for the longer term, either for us as a market, for the companies, for the individuals. I'd be curious, when you kind of like take a step back and look at a 50,000 foot view, what else is happening in the aftermath of these massive breakdowns?
Well, the first thing I like to bring up is the people, because when you look behind all of these accounting frauds, behind the machinations of the fraud itself, these are really stories about people and choices. And so many lives are impacted. So I tell people when I speak that my team and I literally watched as tens of thousands of our coworkers were laid off. And so we're watching them leave the buildings carrying the last of their belongings in these small cardboard boxes. WorldCom once employed 100,000 people. I think when I left, they were down to 50 to 60,000. So you think about these innocent people who lose their jobs. You think about the millions of shareholders who lose their retirement and life savings. So it really has a huge impact on individuals. And within organizations, it's totally chaotic after one of these scandals. So if you had stepped into WorldCom's headquarters, at one point, the headquarters became this sea of empty cubicles. Employees aren't sure what to expect. They're not sure whether they're going to keep their job. You end up losing a lot of good talent. Talent just leaves the company, right? Because you've lost the public trust. You lose revenue and customers, and these companies often end up having to file bankruptcy. So there are short-term consequences. And then, of course, there are long-term consequences, because when you have these frauds, Congress often comes in to pass legislation. Sometimes the pendulum swings too far. I would argue that with SOX 404, early on, right, we were testing very detailed transactional controls down in the bowels of a company that are not likely to prevent or detect these large on-top collusive frauds. So when I think of regulation, it's all about balance, right? We want the right balance. You don't want to weigh down the economy, quash innovation. At the same time, you want to have strong and effective controls in place as well. So yeah, long-term consequences, more oversight within the organization, of course. You're probably going to have a corporate examiner. And of course, for the country, legislation is passed. And as you said, it changes everything, right? We now have the PCAOB, and we have whistleblower hotlines. The SEC, I think, has paid out over $1 billion to whistleblowers who call in and report information that leads to a penalty. The whistleblower is able to get between 10 and 30%. And so that's really been a game changer for society. And organizations realize that they really need to up their game in terms of encouraging their employees to speak up and report things early because problems rarely get better with time, and that they take those calls seriously. I do want to point out that in the case of Bernie Madoff, Harry Markopoulos, the Madoff whistleblower, wrote 5 letters to the SEC, and he was not taken seriously. So one of the lessons coming out of all this is, no matter what you think in terms of a person's motives or whether you like the person, it's important to take the emotion out of it, right? And then go back to the facts of the case and make sure that you take everything that's brought forward seriously and that it's properly investigated and resolved.
Speaking of some of the human consequences, I think that was probably one of the most gripping parts about your book, Extraordinary Circumstances, just looking at what the effects on regular people were, on mid-level managers and beyond. I'm curious, in hindsight, is there anything you didn't get to cover in your book that you wish you could have?
I think I've pretty much covered everything. The book goes through the rise and fall of Verocom, you know, what really caused this company's collapse from a strategy perspective, a risk management, a governance perspective. I wrote the book in present tense because I wanted people to feel as if they were there with me and my team as we navigated the situation. I wanted them to be able to put themselves in the shoes of some of the mid-level managers who became complicit, board members. Imagine that they were sitting in general counsel's shoes, senior executives, and, you know, think about what they might have done if they were in those same situations. So I really put people right at the crossroads of making these decisions so that they can recognize these ethical dilemmas. And the other thing that I did was to walk through the aftermath. I wanted people to understand, if you're with an Enron or a WorldCom or any of these big companies that have scandals, what does that look like? What does it feel like? And what I'm doing is giving readers this kind of vicarious experience, right? Where they can imagine all of these things and they can glean these lessons that they can take back to their organizations, make changes from an organizational perspective, and also personal lessons. So how do you navigate something like this? And what can you do in your personal life to make sure that you know what you stand for, that you've defined those values that are important, that you're able to find your courage, and that you really understand that ethics is more simple, I think, than some of us want to make it. It's really about knowing what you believe and then having the fortitude and the grit to stand up and act based on those values and what you believe in.
Well, Cynthia, phenomenal insights. As we get ready to wrap up, we often end with a closing question, a little bit lighthearted. For some very quick background, we have done an entire bracket of accounting movies, watched and discussed which are the better ones, and I think we're actually kind of like down to the end, which is a perfect opportunity to ask you, what do you think is the best accounting movie, however you would define an accounting movie, and we'll leave that unsaid.
Yeah, that's key, right? How do you define an accounting movie? I mean, I think you and I have talked about before, Smartest Guys in the Room is a great movie. I love The Dropout. I don't know if you consider that an accounting movie on Hulu. I thought that was fantastic. And then, you know, I liked The Big Short. I thought that was a great movie. I thought they did a terrific job describing very complex financial instruments with the CDOs and the credits, default swaps, and subprime mortgages. And it really helped me to understand how this systemic risk was really able to grow unseen between all of the regulatory gaps and the role that conflicts of interest played, and just not understanding the risk, right, within the organization as well as the systemic risk. So I thought that the screenwriters did a great job of that one. It's kind of tough to pick. I'd be interested to know what you guys think.
Well, I always go back to The Smartest Guys in the Room because, you know, Enron was happening as I was graduating. So, you know, we were all kind of enthralled by it, and then had sort of, I don't consider myself a student, but at least some of the accounting things that happened, I sort of dug into that in grad school. So I always go with that one. It would actually be interesting. I do want to hear your movie, Catherine, but Cynthia, I appreciate it. Is there an equivalent movie for WorldCom? I don't think there is. Is there?
There is not. There is not an equivalent.
Oh, that's
I think
bad.
We need to write the screenplay for that. Maybe.
Yeah, let's do it, Catherine.
Yeah.
Kathy,
that movie will be my best accounting movie, I think.
Okay.
Cynthia and my movie. Well,
we're rolling out next year, right?
Yeah.
I love it. Well, Cynthia Cooper, such a pleasure to have you. Just a wonderful discussion, full of insights. Thank you so much. On behalf of us and certainly our listeners, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Catherine.
Well, huge thanks again to Cynthia Cooper for joining us. And thank you, dear listener, also for surfing along. I'm Steve Soter. That was Catherine Tsai. And this has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva. Now, you can see Cynthia Cooper at Amplify. For more information, check out workiva.com/amplify for how you can join us in Denver in person or virtually.
Please subscribe and follow us so you don't miss our next episode. If you like Off the Books, please leave a review. Tell your buddies if you liked the show. If you're watching this on YouTube, drop us a note in the comments or feel free to drop us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. Surf's up and we'll see you on the next wave.